All right. Well, welcome back, everybody. It's good to see you all. I want to quickly review. We started, you know, I know we started the Olivet quite a few months ago, and we took a summer break, and we started last week trying to examine the eighth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, known as the letter Chet, or Ches, depending on where your Ashkenazic or Sephardi pronunciation. But what's fascinating, we mentioned last time, we really only got to its number. We didn't talk about the form. We didn't talk about the Talmudic passage that we always quote about the Olivet. So that's our goal for tonight. But let's just start by reviewing a little bit. In terms of the number eight, the number eight is a wonderful, wonderful number in Judaism, as are all the numbers. But when you contrast it with six and seven, we came out with an amazing insight. We saw that the number six, everything in our physical world is centered on the number six. Everything in our physical world is a 3D model, and everything that's a 3D shape has six sides to it. And six really represents the physical world in which we live. Hence, God created our universe in 6 days. But then came along number seven. Number seven was that idea of taking that physical universe and infusing it with a spiritual component. Again, using that cube, that 3D model as our example, besides for the six spaces, you have the center, the space that it actually occupies. That's its inner content. That's really number seven. And again, using the model of the world that God created, where the physical world was created in 6 days, God infused a sense of spirituality called Shabbat. And it puts a perspective on the entire 6 day work week, or the 6 days of the week. Seven really represented that balance between physicality and spirituality. However, we introduced the concept that the letter Chet, the number eight, really takes it to a new level. It's beyond the natural limitations of the physical world, even beyond the spiritual within the physical. This is a sense, I love to use the word transcendence, of going higher, above and beyond, more the metaphysical world. The examples that I brought were focused on the fact that the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem when it stood, there were so many things that represented that higher level of spirituality and what we can glean living here in this world, that the number eight appeared many, many times in conjunction with the temple, whether it had to do with the special eight garments that the high priest wore when he did the service, the eight varieties of spices that were brought every day as part of the incense offering, the poles to carry the vessels, there were eight of them, eight musical accompaniments for all of the offerings that were brought, the fact that there was a minimum of 8 days that had to transpire before an animal was allowed to be brought as an offering, and on and on and on and on, where the number eight was very visible when we talked about the temple. But then we introduced, and we said, things that are a little bit more common to us, things that we're more familiar with, things like Brit Milah, circumcision, being on the eighth day. Why is that? So we explained how the Brit, that covenant, that's really what the word Brit means, a treaty or a covenant. This is our treaty, our covenant with God, becoming loyal subjects to God. That's really what it is. It takes place on the eighth day. We pointed out, just refreshing your memories, I'm sure you all remember it anyway, the fascinating conversation that took place between Isaac and Ishmael as to who performed their Brit on a higher level. Ishmael, he got his Brit on when he was 13 years of age. Isaac, he got it on 8 days old. And Ishmael makes the argument to say, why is that so cool? You didn't have any say in the matter. You were an 8 day old infant, really nothing to speak of. You didn't choose anything. Me, on the other hand, I chose willingly, voluntarily to subjugate myself to this. I made a free will decision. My act is much more of a sign of loyalty and commitment than it is to just have it done to you at an age where it doesn't matter. This is Yishmael's argument to Yitzchak. However, we pointed out that Yitzchak had a fascinating response. He said, it's true, you made a free will choice, but only because you wanted to do it. You wanted to be in that relationship. When you decide you no longer want to be in that relationship, you're going to pull out. The same free will choice to go in, you're using the same free will choice to get out. And therefore, it's nothing great. Unfortunately, in relationships, or more specifically, when you talk about treaties and covenants, that's something that's binding, even if you're not in the mood. If you make a treaty with your neighbor, that, you know, in legal terms, it's called, what's it called? An easement. You have an easement on your property. Thanks, Ilana. You have an easement. I got that little voice in my ear telling me, right? You have that, you make an agreement with your neighbor that these 2 feet, 3 feet, because you're building your deck, and you work out a deal that they allow you to use that and you cover the taxes, whatever the deal is, that's a treaty. You're not in the mood anymore. You can't just say, sorry, I renege on the deal. A deal is a deal. It's a treaty. It's a covenant. Yitzchak argues and he says, I'm in this forever. This is under all circumstances. Not just because I was in the mood. I was in favor of it. In relationships, unfortunately, there are times where it gets rocky. That's a fact. It never, ever, ever is 100% smooth. However, if you're committed to that relationship, you go through the highs and you go through the lows and you stay committed to it. Sometimes you can't, and that's why you do leave a relationship if it doesn't work. But the concept is that even at times when perhaps logically we should separate, we don't. And therefore, on the eighth day, Yitzchak argues and says it represents the idea that the Jewish people making this treaty are saying, I may not be perfect, and sometimes I don't follow your commandment, God, but you're still my God. I know I have that relationship with you. I know that you'll watch over and protect me as part of the Jewish people. Or vice versa. If sometimes we feel God isn't treating us properly, if that's a feeling we have. And unfortunately, there have definitely been instances in our history that we've could have felt that way, whether it be exile, persecution, forms of anti-Semitism. We don't forsake God. God does not forsake us. That's a brit. That's a covenant. And therefore, it's done on that eighth day because it's beyond the logic. It's beyond the natural limitations that one would expect in a physical world. You're in the mood, yes. You're not in the mood, no. No, we do it on the eighth day because this is a bond. This is a bond that defies, or to use my word, that transcends all levels of intellect, logic, natural order. That's the bond that we have in terms of our relationship with God. So we talked about that. We talked about tzitzit, right? The mitzvah of wearing tzitzis, the fact that we have 8 strands. Why 8 strings that we have hanging off the corners of our garments? So the Torah tells us, why do we wear tzitzit? Uri'item oto, so that when you see them, you remember God and you remember to perform the commandments that he asks us to do. Why the number 8? 1 string should be enough. For those who put strings on their finger to remember their spouse's birthday, it's a great idea because you don't want to forget. But you don't put 8 strings on your finger, you put 1. And if you're like me and you only look at your other hand sometimes, you make sure you have 1 on each hand. But that's it. You don't do 8. Why do we have 8 strands as part of our tzitzit? Perhaps it's for this same reason. And that it's reminding us that at the core of my relationship with God, it's the number 8. It's above and transcends perhaps even logic, and it transcends everything else that goes on in life. That is the definition of this bond. Okay. But then we introduced, and this will be the last part of the review, and we'll use it as a segue to move into tonight's class. We talked about perhaps the most famous 8, that if you were to ask anybody on the street and say, what thing in Judaism is 8? Most people will say, oh, sure, that's the 8 days of Hanukkah. The 8 days of Hanukkah, right? If you're Adam Sandler, right? The 8 days of Hanukkah. So what's up with that? Why are there 8 days of Hanukkah? So understanding this concept where the number eight really is representative of above, beyond logic, we understand that the word miracle falls right into that category. What do we define as a miracle? Miracles are those things that we can't explain logically. It defies logic. It doesn't seem to make sense. How could water of an entire sea split? The nature of water is that you take two molecules of it and they find each other. They bond together. You mean to tell me that the sea split? You mean to tell me that manna fell from heaven for 40 years to sustain the Jewish people? Oh, come on. That's not logical. That's not normal. That's what we use the word miracles. Hanukkah is the miracle, is the holiday that celebrates this concept of a miracle. Why? We all familiar. There's two aspects of the Hanukkah story. One is that you have this small ragtag group of Jews who are not soldiers in any way, shape, or form, who wage the battle against the great, powerful Greek army. And yet they win. It defies any logic. It makes no sense. And even after they've won the war and they're able to go back into the temple and they want to rededicate it, so they're looking for oil. And what do they find? Just one flask. One unopened flask of oil with enough oil to last just one day. We're all familiar with the story. You're probably wondering why I'm talking about this 4 days before Rosh Hashanah. I'm way off on my calendar, but bear with me. Okay. So they find this one jug, and it doesn't burn for just one day. It lasts for 8 days. Hence the miracle, we celebrate 8 days. But now you know one more piece of the story that makes sense. They found that jug. How did they know that that jug was still pure? All the other jugs had become defiled. Remember, the Greeks did not destroy the temple. They defiled it. The building still stood. It's not until a few hundred years later when the Romans come to destroy it. The Greeks never destroyed it. They defiled it. So all of the oil that they did find other oil, but it was unusable because it became impure and defiled. So how did they know this one little jug was not defiled, not impure? It had a seal on it, did it not? The seal was of what? What was it? Was it the president's signature? No. But it had somebody's imprint on it. Anybody know? It was the high priest, the Kohen Gadol. The seal that showed that the bottle had not been opened, the seal, like a signet ring kind of mark on the flask, was still intact. And therefore, they knew that the Greeks had not defiled that one jug. But does it not strike you strange? Why of all the things? Why? Because the concept had to be that this whole story of Hanukkah is above limitations. It transcends. It's miraculous. Who is the person that represents all the service in the temple? It's the Kohen Gadol. It's the high priest. The number eight, the special eight garments that he wore. It all ties together to that concept. In fact, in Hebrew, the number eight is called Shmona. Shmona. Shmona is spelled with four letters. Shin, Mem, Nun, He. Fran's smiling because she figured it out already. Shmona are the same letters as Hashemen, which means the oil. Yeah, as in the same story, Hanukkah. But wait, it gets better. You know what else are those four letters? Neshama, your soul. Yeah, it also defies logic. It's not bound by anything in the physical world. It's not even an element of physicality that's infused. No, it is number eight. It is way out there. It is transcendent above our world. And so is the word Mishnah. By the way, it's all the same four letters. These are the concepts that show us that our connection to God through Torah allows us to transcend above and beyond anything in the physical world of six, or even the spiritually infused physicality of our world of seven. Eight allows us to go even higher. It makes sense now why the Greeks, they outlawed only a handful of commandments. Only a handful of mitzvot did they actually outlaw. If you wanted to keep kosher, you were allowed to keep kosher. They had no issue with that. If you wanted to give tzedakah, they had no problem with that. If you wanted to not speak Lashon Hara, that was fine. But you know what they outlawed? They outlawed Brit Milah. They outlawed circumcision. Why? Of all things, why? So there's different answers that are proposed. But the Greeks were all about the body. The Greeks, that's where the Olympics come from. It's celebrating and perhaps even idolizing the physical nature of things. They didn't want to hear anything about there's a concept of a soul, spirituality. They didn't want to hear from any of that stuff. And therefore, what they outlawed were all the things that impressed and forged that relationship that we believe in so wholeheartedly. That's what they were against. I want to read you a beautiful, beautiful insight. I can't do it justice to just summarize it. I want to read it to you. It's fascinating. How many of us, unfortunately, go through life with the words, if only? If only. Where did I put it? Sorry, give me one more second here. That's what happens when you do too much research, too many papers. Oh, you know what? Smarty pants. I took it out. That's why I can't find it. Here it is. Okay. Oh, I got this popping up here. Okay. When you operate from the level of seven, you are constricted by your circumstances. Who you are and what you have to work with truly might not be enough to allow your light to shine. Excuse me. But when you choose, like the Maccabees, to go beyond measured reason and use whatever you do have, regardless of whether or not it seems like enough, a new reality comes into play. Often in the course of ordinary life, we feel blocked from fulfilling our true potential. We tell ourselves that we could be better, more, if only. If only takes many forms. If only I had a more nurturing childhood. If only I had more money. If only I were married. If only I were divorced. If only my friends were more supportive. If only I had more time. If only I wasn't so afraid. If only I was sure it would work. If only I was a different type. If only I knew how. And the list goes on and on and on. If only is from the realm of seven. When you operate in your life from seven, what you have, like I said, who you know, how you feel, actually does make a very big difference. If you need oil for 8 days and you only have enough for one, you're out of luck. The power of eight isn't affected by if only. When you operate from eight, you disregard your limiting circumstances and commit yourself to creating the world you want to experience from the pure source of who you are, even if you don't know how. When you do this with trust and faith, as did the Maccabees, just a very small amount of oil can create all the light you need. Ask yourself, what is it that's standing in the way of your light today? Doesn't have to stop you. Instead, you can use it to make your light shine. You just have to replace the if only with the vision of what you really want and be willing to take action toward that vision one little step at a time. I could not say that any better. What a great idea. It summarizes so beautifully what this number eight is all about. Miracles, not being affected by the if onlys. I share this with you because we are 4 days before Rosh Hashanah. And we all get that feeling of, if only. If only I had done this over the year. If only I had paid more attention to that. And we start going down the list of the if onlys. And instead of being inspired, we get depressed. Because it sounds vaguely familiar from exactly a year before that, that I went down that list. And you know what? I think I said the same thing. If only I had, don't go there. Don't go there. Because that's the realm of seven. We have the ability to be eight. We have the ability to go above that and say, yes, I do wish I had that, but I'm going to commit to take one step forward to make it a reality. How am I going to get there? Logistically, I don't know. Logically, I don't know. I don't know all the answers. I have no idea, but I know I'm going to take one step forward today. And you know what I'm going to do tomorrow? I'm going to take another small step. I don't know how the end plays out. I don't know what's coming around the bend. Who saw this pandemic coming? Nobody. But that's the fact. And now we deal with it. And we put one foot in front of the other, and we make sure that we still have classes, and we make sure that we reach out to our friends, and we make sure of all the things that we really want in life. You'll ask me, how am I going to get there? I don't know. I don't know, but I don't care. I'm going to do my darndest. Eight says I can do it. That's why it's important to understand this concept. But now I've done a disservice. Because now I just killed myself to go ahead and kill a great speech for Rosh Hashanah that I'm supposed to be writing up that you're going to see at some point. So I got to come up with a new one. But you need to know the concept. This is important. Let's take a few minutes to now take a step back and try to understand the form of the letter Chet. Let's take a look here. I'm going to share my screen if I remember how to do this. Share screen. Here it is. Ah, there we go. Okay. You see my, do you guys see my cursor? It's moving. Yes. Over here. Okay. So the last letter here on the left of the top line is this eighth letter that we're calling the Chet, right? Aleph is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And this is number 8. This is the form of the letter 8 as it's written in the Torah scroll itself. Now, there's two ways to look at this. The letter Chet, I know it's not what you thought it was going to be, but if you look, there's three components to it. You have some letter on the right side, almost the exact same letter, in fact, the same letter on the left side, and then some little bridge at the top combining them. So if you recall, or you just want to take a quick look at the letter beforehand, oh, there it is. The letter Zion, number 7, is right here. It's in duplicate. The letter Chet, actually, in the Torah scroll, is written as one Zion. Then next to it is another Zion, and then you build the roof. You build the bridge on top. Two Zions with a roof, as they say in Frederick, right? What's up with that? So I'll be honest, I didn't find a lot of material about it. I saw a couple of insights that I'll share with you, but there's a second version. Most Torah scrolls have it like this, where the letter Chet is written as two Zions with a bridge. There is a version, according to the Arizal, based on Kabbalah, based on mysticism, that the letter on the right side is actually the previous letter, the letter Vav, number 6. This is a Vav, the one on the right side is a Vav. And then the one on the left side is the Zion, and then connected at the top. So it's either two Zions connected or a Vav and Zion connected, and we're going to explore the deeper meaning of both of them. Are we good so far? Okay. So let's do the two Zions that are connected at the top first. Well, if you recall, the word Zion, we broke it down that there were two almost conflicting meanings of that letter Zion. On the one hand, it was related to the word zon, like we say in benching and grace after meals, birkat hamazon, hazon et olam kulo. So zon means the one who sustains, and it's talking about God who provides for the entire world. But on the other hand, we learned that the word Zion actually meant a weapon. It was something that man, humankind, utilized to accomplish. Either it would be at war, or more specifically, when we talked about it, it was man's war against the ground to try to produce the wheat, try to produce the food. And we struggled. On the one hand, it's God who's providing, and that's what we're led to believe, and that's what we should believe. That's what the Torah teaches us. Hazan et ha'olam kulo, that it is God who provides it all. But on the other hand, I have to work my tuchus off. I have to work hard. I have to battle with the ground to produce all of it. Comes along the letter chet, and it says, there's a way to balance them both. You can have both a Zion on the right side, representing God being Zun, providing the sustenance. But you also have a Zion on the left side, which shows us that man, human activity, is able to produce also. But they're not warring. You'll note that they are connected at the top. There's a way to balance it. It is symbolizing that achievement of balancing what seem to be contradictory Zions. You're able to accomplish that. So the two Zions coming together to fruition are symbolized by this letter. But there's more, because it can even leave God out of the picture. And you can have just two people who are fighting. Each one of them has some kind of Zion, some kind of weapon, whether it's a physical weapon, or the way they're speaking to each other, or the way they're interacting, but there's a tension, there's a battle going on between them. It comes along the letter Chet and says, there has to be a way. We have to figure out a way, how to build a bridge, how to connect them, how to build some kind of friendship in the relationship. You cannot leave two Zions out there alone to keep slugging it out over and over and over again. Bridges need to be built. I think in the culture we are finding ourselves right now is a lesson we all need to take to heart. There's plenty of Zion going on. Plenty of weapons, plenty of warring of words, plenty of hatred and poison. Comes along the letter Chet, which, by the way, the Talmud says stands for the most famous, perhaps the most famous word that begins with the letter Chet. It's called Chayim, life, Chai. You want to know what Chai, you know what Chayim is all about? Building bridges between warring parties. Building bridges between people who on the surface cannot see eye to eye. It's my Zion, not your Zion. No, you got it wrong. It's my Zion, not yours. Comes along the letter Chet of Chai, learning to live, learning to build those bridges of friendship. This is how many of the commentators that I came across discuss the form of the letter Chet. However, as I mentioned, The Arizal had a different form to this letter. And instead of it being two Zions, it's a one Vav and one Zion. Bear with me. The commentaries tell us, you know, if you have to pick two partners that you want to build a bridge to work together, the perfect prototype would be man and woman. The male and the female. And without getting too mystical with the Kabbalah, in many places it talks about the Vav being representative of the male and the Zion being representative of the female. On a simple level, there's a verse in Mishlei in Proverbs that says very clearly that a wife is considered Atara Lebala, is the crown of her husband. If you look at the difference between the Vav, that's just a straight at the top, as opposed to the Zion that has a crown, that's much more representative of the female, who is the crown of the family. When you put a Vav and Zion together, representing that marriage between the union of a male and a female. But you add something at the top. They don't just stand opposite each other. You have a bridge, you have something at top that's representing God. We've said this many times, that in Judaism, we view a partnership not between two players, but rather between three. There's the formation of a child takes three partners. I know, shocking. But yes, there's three partners. There's the male, there's the female, and then there's God. Take a Vav and a Zion, but you have to put God at the top. Just out of curiosity, does anyone note the form and structure, the shape of the letter Chet, looking something about or similar to something related to a marriage? Does it look like something you're familiar with?
A chuppah?
A chuppah? Yes, that is exactly what it is. A chuppah. That's correct. It's the canopy upon under which the bride and groom get married. That's like the classic Jewish symbol of a marriage, is under the chuppah. Yes, united under the chuppah. In fact, some want to argue and say that the word chuppah stands for two words, chet po. The letter chet, which represents the three partners, the vav, the zayin, the male, the female, and the top of God, right? Those three connected are here under the chuppah itself. The word chuppah can be broken down into chet, the three entities, po are here. Chet, pe, he. All three entities are here. The truth is that is the secret for a successful marriage. The secret to a successful marriage is that it must include godliness. I'm sure many of you have heard this before, but it bears repeating. The Hebrew word for man is ish, and it's spelled with three Hebrew letters, Aleph, Yud, and Shin. The Hebrew word for woman is Isha, which is spelled Aleph, Shin, He. If you've been writing this down or mentally making note of it, you will note that both the man and the woman, the Ish and the Isha, sound very similar, and they have two letters that they share in common. They share the letter Aleph and the letter Shin. Well, Aleph and Shin together spell a word, Ish. Not just the name of an organization, but Aish means fire, passion. Well, that's one ingredient to a good marriage. There has to be some level of passion. There has to be a level of fire. But if it's limited to that, then passion can go out of control also. And passion can fizzle. If that's all it's based on, their relationship is just an Aleph and a Shin that they share in common, not sure how long that relationship is going to be successful. But the Torah tells us that there's a way to make it successful, and that's adding a letter to each of them. To the man, instead of it just being Aleph and Shin, you add a Yud. Hence, you have the name Ish. And to the female, to the woman, you add the letter He for Isha. Hey. Yud and He, when you combine them together, now you're talking about God's name. Yud and He are the first two letters of God's ineffable name. So what you've done is you've taken Aish, the passion and love that the husband and wife have for each other, and you've infused within it godliness. And you have a structure now that isn't just based on passion, but it also includes that godliness. The love between the husband and the wife, right, should be reciprocal, meaning it needs to go in both ways. The ahava, which is the Hebrew word for love, the word ahava has the numerical value of 13. Aleph is 1, he is 5, bet is 2, and he is another 5, makes 13. When you have ahava from one spouse to the other, and then it's reciprocated back between the both of them, 13 going one way, 13 going the other way is a grand total of 26. 26. 26 is the number that represents God's name, the Yud, the He, the Vav, and the He. Yeah, That is the ultimate. When you are able to truly create that love that has godliness within it, that's what the 26 represents. Now you're cooking. Now you got what it takes to be successful. It's not surprising, therefore, that the two letters that combine are the Vav and the Zion, right? Vav is 6, Zion is 7. What's 6 and 7? 13. It all comes down to this. The concept here that I'm trying to impress upon you is that this form, when you have the chet, which represents a chuppah, which represents the successful union between a husband and a wife, it is most successful when you look at the structure of it, and it always, 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 whether you look at it from a mathematical perspective or simply the structure of the letter, it always comes down to having godliness infused within it. The Hebrew word for marriage is kiddushin. Kiddushin comes from the word kadosh, holiness. The union that is built on holiness is the secret for that successful relationship and includes the top piece, the bridge that combines it. But we can take it even further. Let's take it a little bit further. I quote to you always when we talk about the letters. The Talmud in the Tractate Shabbat always, in that one section, goes through the meanings of all of the letters. And we went through it, Aleph through Zion. Aleph through Zion. But we went ahead and we said the following. The Talmud says that if you do Aleph Bet, you go ahead and you learn Bina, right? Bina. Then Gomel Dalid was Gimel Dalid, where you bestow kindness to the poor. Then Hevav, which was godliness, Hevav. Then God will be Zan, he will sustain you. And then comes to our letter. Not only will he sustain you, but he will give you Chain, not Chrein. Chrein is horseradish, don't confuse them. Chain is favor, grace, I don't know what other word, beauty. It has a very, in Yiddish we use it all the time. Oh, that person has such chain. There's a certain beauty, there's an innate beauty and grace to the person. That's what the Talmud says here, that if you follow the progression of the letters, and Aleph Bet, and you do Gimel Dalet, then the Hey Vav, which represents God, will be Zan, he will sustain you, and give you chain, that you will find favor, grace in the eyes of others. Why is this word chain? It's such a weird word. Why does it mean grace or beauty or find favor in the eyes? So some suggest that it comes from the word chinam. Chinam means free, unearned. Again, relating to our high holidays that are soon to be upon us. We ask God, one of the attributes that we try to tap into is we say, Hashem, Hashem, oh God, Rachum v'chanun, you are merciful and gracious, comes from that word chinam, that he's willing to grant us kindness, even if our merits are inadequate. You're just a giving person. You're willing to find favor in your eyes, that we should find favor in your eyes, even though we don't deserve it. Chain is from the word chinam, means free, unearned. Yet God is still willing to do it. But there's more. Because I can't let it go, but I'm stuck on the holiday of Chanukah. Chanukah, the first two letters are chain. What's the difference? Who cares? Ah. Let's go to the very first occurrence of the word chain in the Torah. I've said it, and I want to repeat it. They say over in the names of the great sages that the first occurrence of something in the Torah is its primary source, even if it's repeated many, many times later. You always try to find what's the very first occurrence. So the very first occurrence, interestingly enough, is not about Adam. It's not about Eve. It's not about Cain or Abel or even their next son, Chase. It's not about any of them. The very first time the word chain appears is in reference to Noach, Noah. In fact, the verse says, "V'Noach matza chain be'enei Hashem," and Noah found favor in the eyes of God. Now, does anything strike you about the name Noach and the word chen? Yeah, it's the exact same two letters in different order. Noach is nun chet. Chen is chet nun. So it's almost like a, what's that called? An onomatopoeia of where you play with it and you have it sounding like. So Noach and Chen, the same letters spelled frontwards and backwards, they're juxtaposed right in the same sentence. Noach, Matzah, Chen. You know what makes Chen so beautiful? Not just because the person has a nice appearance, but Chen is used when you want to talk about beauty or grace of when it's something that's juxtaposed with its opposite. Chen is the beauty of symmetry. When you are, particularly when you're comprised of two opposite elements that are reflecting each other. Noach, chen, the chet and the nun. They symbolize these two things. Underlying, why is it that when you have two opposites that seem, you know, to be mirroring each other, it creates a certain artistic beauty? Because underlying is a unity that shows and it's forming a common source to both sides. I'll give you an example. In the story of Hanukkah, it's the story of light over darkness. That's what we always say, that the candles of Hanukkah are there to illuminate the darkness. The Greeks who tried to, so to say, darken our lives in the sense of taking away our connection to God and Torah, thereby taking away our light, we go ahead and we celebrate by lighting candles, illuminating out the darkness. We don't do this mitzvah by day because you have sunlight. But in the dead of night, when it's pitch dark, we light candles. The battle of light and darkness. But don't ever forget, light has an element of darkness too. Try staring at the sun. Light can blind you as if you couldn't see. And just like light can blind you, darkness also contains a radiant light. They both have each other's elements. The miracle of Hanukkah, the ability to revive that spark of light that resides within the hidden recesses, the darkness within each one of us, is the symbol of lighting the Hanukkah candles in darkness. Why do we light it? Not for the outside world only, but for the inside of us, our essence. Within our own darkness, and we all have it, some degrees higher than others, but everybody has what they need to improve on. Everybody has that, but at the same time, everybody also has that light within them, that spark of light, the ability to be able to balance those, what seem to be opposites. Within the darkness, I can find light, and I'm wary that even in light, I can fall prey to darkness. That symmetry of within each one, where they balance each other, even though they're opposites, that's what chen is. Chen applies so beautifully now when we talk about this letter chet as being the letter symbolizing the chuppah of a marriage. Isn't that what a marriage is? A relationship of quote unquote opposites? We don't marry the same person you are. That doesn't work. Opposites attract. You don't find somebody exactly like you. But in fact, what it is two different people who create that symmetry of being opposites to create that wholesome unifying force. Chen applies for marriages of opposing forces that blend into that symmetrical beauty. It is therefore the letter chuppah, the word chuppah, right? The letter chet that combines the vav and the zayin, the male and the female, because that's what this letter chet is. This letter for chuppah, it's the letter for chen, it's the letter for chai. They all have the same connotation of where you go ahead and you take that seemingly opposites and you're able to forge them with that sense of godliness and purpose that combines both of them. This perhaps is the deeper meaning behind the form and structure of the letter chet. I should have warned you, I was gonna go deep tonight, but didn't have time. Let me take questions if anyone has just even if it's just to clarify if anything wasn't clear.
Since there can be two ways of looking at it, like as you explained it, with the Zions or the Zion and the Vav, which way is more accepted and which way do you think?
That's a good question. They're both halachically acceptable. I think that the general tradition in most Torah scrolls is to follow the two Zion approach. Most Torah scrolls that I'm familiar with, you do it as two Zions. But there is a valid source to do a Vav and a Zion also. I don't know which scribes choose which ones. I don't know that. But typically, if you open up a Torah scroll, they're all, as far as I know, it's two Zions.
Thank you.
Did it come across what I'm trying to get in terms of that the letter Chet is that concept of the two, whether it's two Zions or Vav and Zion, either way, they're not exactly the same. There's a warring, there's an opposite, a tension, but the way to do it is by bridging it. There has to be a way to bridge it, even in interpersonal relationships that we learn to bridge and create that friendship, or even on a higher level, all relationships have to include that sense of godliness above that allow us to form that beauty of unifying the two opposing forces. If it didn't come across, hopefully it did now. Okay. Any other questions? Everybody take two Motrin. You'll be fine by the morning.
Good.
Want to wish each of you a Shana Tova, a happy year, a healthy, healthy, healthy year. Most importantly, a year of success, and that we should all continue to manage through the difficulties, but grow from them, not just tolerate, right? Who always says, I don't just survive, I try to thrive. And that's what we're going to continue trying to do. So I wish each of you a happy, a healthy new year, a sweet new year, a year of continued growth. And we'll pick this up again, God willing, next week, next Tuesday night at 8. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, don't matter. Just tell anybody. Tuesday night at 8. And we will, God willing, start with the letter Tet. All right?
Good night, everybody.
Thank you for Marcus's.
Yeah. Thank you so
pleasure.
Much.
Nice to see you. Well, nice to hear you all.
Thank you. Thank
you. All right. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.
Good night.
Have a good night.